Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland, and here's a reminder that the comments, views, and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of WCOM, its board, and underwriters. And now, today's program. Today's topic is veterans entering transition. I'm talking with a team of people who serve this group, and their organization is aptly named Veterans Entering Transition. They are a nonprofit group, and their website is myusvet.org. My first guest is Ann Showalter. Ann is the founder of Veterans Entering Transition and has over 25 years working in marketing and over 30 years working with nonprofits. As a young girl, Ann was exposed to and supported her grandfather, who was an alderman and a campaign manager with local districts outside of Chicago. She is also the daughter of a Vietnam vet and was always taught to give back to the community, which has led to her involvement with helping veterans and various organizations. My second guest is Mike McMichael, and Mike is the co-founder of Outside the Wire Group Foundation. After serving in Iraq, in January 2005, he returned with no visible injuries despite having survived an IED explosion just weeks before. But after years of suffering with a multitude of physical and emotional symptoms that almost led to the loss of his family, this led to the realization that our nation's heroes are coming home and needing help. Help that only another vet can provide. So Outside the Wire Group was formed as an answer to the silent cry for help for many of our wounded soldiers. Through advocacy, outreach, training and solutions, and consulting, Outside the Wire Group provides results that have an immediate and direct impact on the improvement of the health care and personal welfare of our veteran heroes. And my third guest today is Amanda Gwynn. Amanda is going to share a bit of her family story of dealing with the veteran entering transition from active duty to civilian life and the aftermath of those invisible wounds of PTSD and how she became involved in the Veterans Entering Transition program. Everybody, welcome to the show. Ann, if you will get us started and explain to us what Veterans Entering Transition is and why you just started. You founded the organization.
Okay. Well, Veterans Entering Transition is there to help our veterans and families transition back into family, community, and workforce readiness. And by doing so, we've created a consortium of resources that will help them through the various steps that, or phases that they'll go through. And that can include things like peer-to-peer counseling, through our fiscal sponsor, Outside the Wire Group, to family therapy to coincide so that we can get the veteran and their families on the right track. It will include health, wellness, and nutrition, financial planning. We work with our local community colleges to help with the transition back into work. So there's a bunch of services available out there, and we just try to put everything under one umbrella, so that it's easier for veterans and their families to navigate.
So you're acting as a focal point for all the other services that are out there?
Yes.
So a veteran comes to you, how do they find you?
Through our website, social media, word of mouth.
And so let's give your website.
Our website is www.myusvet.org.
And so when they come to the website, what are they going to find there? Is there a form they need to click on? How do they go through the process of getting in touch with you?
There is a form that they can click on, and we'll ask just very brief questions, and then someone from our organization will reach out to them to see what type of services that they're in need of.
And so when they're coming to you, is it normally like their last opportunity to try to get help? Are they at the end of their rope, or are some of them coming just as soon as they know they're going to transition from the military?
It's a combination of both, and we work not just with exiting military, but we also work with retired veterans as well that may be going through some type of other transition in their life, but they know that the services and programs are there not just for them, but their family members as well.
And so how does that impact the family members and kind of tell us how they reach out to you and what some of the stories are?
Well, one of our stories I have sitting with us, that's Amanda Gwynn. She can share her story, but then we've got another family, they've been hard on their luck as far as housing and trying to find stable work. So we've been going through the process of trying to find transitional housing with them, putting services in front of them like financial planning and attorneys that might be able to help them with benefits that they might know or may not know exist. I'm sorry. And then also helping with job placement for this family, the veteran and her fiance. Currently, the veteran is gainfully employed, but I think that we can do better. She needs to get her ducks in a row, though, a little bit more. So it's a process.
And when you're talking about helping them get their ducks in a row, what does that process look like?
Well, with every veteran and family, it's different. But for them, it's going to be getting them financially sound. So putting them with a financial planner and teaching them how to budget, how to pay their bills on time.
And so you're working with them to find housing, to find their feet in their career, to just kind of come back into a community, the civilian community, and be able to function then.
Yes, ma'am.
So, Amanda, can you share your story and tell us how you've made that transition and how you decided to connect with veterans entering transition?
Yes, ma'am. Almost 1 year ago, on May 9, 2015, my husband, a veteran of the Gulf War era, took his life. He committed suicide, and I did not know what was going to happen next. So through other nonprofits, I eventually met Anne in a graceful way. Anne kind of took me under her wing and has helped me in many different avenues. The VA has denied any claim to my husband's death of any of his war affiliations. And they have also denied his burial. So Anne is...
Wow.
Yes. Anne is helping me try to maneuver through the VA. I have gotten a lot of his medical records for proof. She's also connected me with Mike through Outside the Wire and NC for Vets. They're going to try and help my appeal. So all my claims are going to be through affiliates that Anne has connected me with. So during this battle of not only grief, but also... through the battle of the VA, Anne has been by my side the whole time.
Well, thank you for your service and the sacrifice that you and your family and your husband gave for this country. And he just gave the ultimate sacrifice. And to hear that the VA is not recognizing that.
Yes, ma'am.
Is just another tragedy compounding a tragedy.
Yes, ma'am.
So, Anne, when you guys are trying to fight these battles with Amanda and helping her through that, how do our federal and state representatives come into play, if at all?
Well, initially, when I met with Amanda, she had already started the process of going for the death and burial benefits. And the help that I was able to provide initially was to talk to our senators to help push her paperwork through. Ultimately, because it was her second go at getting the benefits, she was denied. So now we have to go through an appeal process, which led me to talk to attorneys and to people from the governor's office and NC4 Vets and Mike also with Outside the Wire Group. We're all working collectively for the good of Amanda and her family.
And for the listeners, is there anything that we can do to show our support in dealing with these types of issues?
Yes. We need the community to be aware of what's going on. And if people would just visit our website, see what services are available. Everybody knows a veteran somewhere, somehow, to some degree. And send them to our website. Let them know that there's organizations out there that are ready and willing to help. And then if they can afford a donation, donations would be great because we need to keep the doors open so that we can continue to provide these services for the families.
Now, you have a fundraiser coming up here in May.
Yes, ma'am.
So tell us a little bit about that and how everyone can support it.
Okay, so we have what we call the Veterans and Community Gala, Bridging the Divide. And that's going to be held May 13th at the Museum of Natural Science, downtown Raleigh, from 6 to 10 p.m. This gala is going to be very interactive. It's cocktail, and there's going to be various forms of entertainment. We'll start off with the National Guard presenting colors, David Crabtree from WRAL with Leslie Flowers from Path of Change will be co-hosting, and then local veteran Ryan Daniel, who is also a CMA artist, is going to be coming in to perform as well.
And so if they go to your website, they can find the information on getting tickets?
Yes, they can purchase tickets there. Another way they can participate if they can't make the gala is if they go to the website, click on buy tickets, it will send them to BidPal. And 48 hours before the gala kicks off, we will have a silent auction that will go live.
Okay, and so what all kinds of items do you have on that silent auction?
We've got some packages from Skin Sense Day Spa. We've got a barn quilt that was custom made. We've got a gift certificate from Direct Diamonds. There's various items up there.
So they're going to find a variety of things, and they should go to myusvets.org.
Yes, ma'am.
And then they can jump over to BidPal to see those types of items 48 hours before the event. So that would be on May 11th.
Yes. And they can actually view the items now. They just can't bid on the items.
Okay, that's great to know. So, Mike, you've gotten involved in this organization, too, and you have your own organization. And so talk about your involvement with Veterans Ending Transition and then your other nonprofit also.
Okay, Lee, what I handle is basically the crisis part of the veteran issue and the family side. The organization I'm with is co-founder of is Outside the Wire Group Foundation, and we're run all by either veterans or family or youth in some way, spouse or youth, family of veterans. Nobody gets a paycheck; everybody's all volunteer, and we basically get the veteran from the point of crisis. That's where we really are our bread and butter. So this is a veteran that is either in mental health trouble or some serious financial trouble or at always the worst point, the worst low is obviously kind of playing suicide. So you ask a very important question, you know, what can people do? Well, definitely, you know, donate to organizations that help veterans in whatever that organization is. But one of the biggest things somebody can do, like Ann mentioned, everybody knows a veteran. You know, find a veteran at least once a week and just ask them if they're okay and let them know somebody loves them. We lose 22, the numbers would be 22 to 24 a day. So basically by the time we're done with this conversation, we would have lost a veteran. That's the data that we have. What we know is it's more, it's really probably more like in the 60s a day, because we're only going off the numbers of what we can get from medical examiners and coroners that actually write down the words veteran and then have suicide on the documentation.
Right, because suicide isn't always apparent. It can be a car accident.
That's right.
It can be any number of things that...
And a lot of time in our rural areas, it's listed as an accidental death to help protect the family.
Right.
So, or the person's just alone and nobody actually knows they're a veteran. And like the younger generation, they don't realize they're veterans. They think they have to serve a full 20 years to be called a veteran. So they'll never identify themselves as a veteran. So when we're actually looking for data on veterans even, we've learned you can't ask, hey, are you a veteran? A lot of the younger generation will check no. You actually have to say, have you served? Well, yes, I have, you know.
Right.
Find those. But outside the wire, how we basically our primary objective is peer-to-peer counseling. So that's veteran to veteran or family member to family member or youth to youth. And we cover all 100 counties in North Carolina. We spread out in several of the states now. It's just word of mouth. But primarily focus on North Carolina. That's all 100 counties. Within 24 hours, I can get someone, at least someone to do a welfare check on somebody. But then in 48 hours, I can get an actual trained peer, someone who's trained and state certified to handle someone in a mental health crisis to start them to basically, they'll be a veteran, they'll show up, be able to shake their hand, give them a hug, and say, hey, brother, hey, sister, I've been where you are, I've been in the depths. I've had that black cloud over me. Follow me. I will lead you to recovery. And that process is a crawl, walk, run situation. That's where, you know, you can't just blast them with all kind of resources and then they're going to go do them. You really have to, when someone's really, truly at the bottom, they're rock bottom, and they're ready to get help for mental health, you have to give them one task, follow it through with them, holding their hand along the way, and then move them to the next. A lot of our soldiers, when they come home, the way I try to put it is, it's like they're still standing in a formation waiting for a senior NCO or officer to tell them what to do next, or to ask them, have you done this task? Have you completed it? So it's just a very tough situation. And mental health is very similar to drug and alcohol use disorders. You're not ready for help until you hit your rock bottom a lot of times and ready to admit you need it and ask for it and need it for yourself.
That visual you just gave of someone still standing in formation, they're standing in that formation, but when they look around, they think they're standing alone.
You're exactly right. It's almost like they dismissed the formation and everybody else was told what to do, but they weren't. And they're still standing there, and their command and all their battle buddies have left, and they're standing there feeling like they have no mission anymore. What am I supposed to do? I wasn't told I could leave. I'm waiting, you know. And the Department of Defense is getting better at out-processing their our soldiers, but it's not as on a personal level as it can be. You know, it's done in masses. You know, it's not as one-on-one as it should be, but that takes time, money, and resources.
Well, and no one knows it better than a vet helping another vet.
That's right. And, you know, that's why it's called peer. To be a peer, you have to pretty much walk in the shoes that person's walked in. So, you know, I've been in my, you can look in otwgroup.com. OTWgroup.org. That's OTWgroup.org. That's where you can find Outside the Wire information about myself and my co-founder. And you'll see that you know, I've walked through some pretty rough shoes since I've gotten home, and I basically did my recovery the wrong way. I wouldn't go to the VA. I wouldn't get help. I wouldn't ask for help. I was ashamed that there were things wrong with me. And that put me in bad places, put me on the way to where I was suicidal. And luckily, my family pushed me into getting help, and I listened, and they saved my life along with the VA and vet centers and a couple of other key battle buddies I had. And, you know, that's just important. That's like I mentioned, you know, we're just standing there waiting in formation. Somebody tells us what to do. And if someone doesn't tell us, he's the one that's doing it wrong, especially when it comes to mental health and substance abuse and things like that.
Well, and it's a not so silent killer. We're losing entirely too many of our veterans and our heroes. The ones of you who give your life to serve, to protect this country, to give us our freedoms. And I think too many people take that for granted. And I think Amanda's story will resonate in that she's been there. She served by having her husband gone and then came home, and now she's lost him to something that the VA won't even, and the government won't even acknowledge is part of the equation.
Lee, that's something I want to say, you know, with Amanda. And we've had this conversation. You know, I have to kind of retrain her thinking a little bit. You know, our military families, our spouses, husbands, wives, children, mothers, fathers, they are military personnel as well. They are soldiers as well. You know, we kind of look at it, you have different levels of soldiering the way we look at it. You've got your door kickers and the guys in the boots on the ground, feet in the mud, right?
Right.
So we should think about this front line. And then behind us, we have all of our support. Now, our wars today, it's a 360, you know, four-dimensional war. It's, they're everywhere, you don't know where good or bad is. It's not like the good guys are this way, bad guys behind you. You know, the support for the troops deployed doesn't just end at the rear lines. It goes all the way back to the house at home. And so our family members, they are soldiers too. And they fight a battle that I personally think is even harder than we fight. We have one job. We know what it is. It has very many tasks to it, but it's one job, one goal. And we know what we're doing. Everybody has a job. These families were left behind with all of a sudden turning into single mothers and single fathers. And, you know, we're left to deal with everything they used to do with a two-parent household, and now it's just a one-parent. And that's very difficult. I think people underestimate that job a lot. Because some of these deployments in the early years, about three were lasting up to 2 years. And now we've got them down to 6 months, but some of these folks have been on 5 or 6 deployments. So, you know, just don't underestimate what those family members have gone through. And I see them as, you know, we call it in the infantry, you earn your combat entrance badge, you know, when you get shot at, basically. I think these folks at home have every bit as much earned the right to call themselves combat veterans, in my opinion.
Well, and the added stress of not knowing where your loved one is at any given time, are they in danger? That adds a special dimension to it. Like she said, you guys know when you're in danger and you're deployed, but everyone waiting at home is wondering if somebody's going to knock on the door or they're going to get a phone call.
That's right, and that's another big part of it. It's actually a true diagnosis now. It's called secondary PTSD, and that's what a family member can get that is a caregiver of someone with PTSD, or just a family member who's a spouse of a veteran that's been deployed overseas. And so that's also part of our program. You know, we deal with the families. Sometimes I will be getting requests from a veteran, and I'm working with the veteran, but I find out there's in our questioning that we do with our we're dealing with an intake process for a veteran, we have direct questions that kind of ask questions about their families, and then a lot of times we find out sometimes the family members need more help than the actual veteran does sometimes.
Well, and that presents an interesting thing for you, Ann, is it's not just veterans entering transition, it's families entering transition, right?
Yes, it is. It is. For me, it's near and dear. My father was a 3-tour Vietnam vet, and when he came home, he was not the same person, and I grew up in a very cold house. It was, he was emotionally detached, and he was an alcoholic. He had a very violent temper. He was suicidal, and there was no help for him. And, you know, growing up watching my father like that was very difficult because there was nothing I can do, and there was no help for the family either. And yeah, my parents, because of my father's tendencies, my mother left when I was 3 years old. He brought her back from Thailand. He met her during the war. And not knowing what her rights were here in America, I wound up being raised by my grandparents because neither of my parents could care for myself or my sister. So it would have been nice to have resources available. And then later on in life, marrying a Desert Storm vet, seeing the challenges that he faced, the challenges that I faced, and us not being on the same page. So that's why it's, for me, it's really important to have programs in place, not just for the veteran, but the family members as well, because they need a voice too.
So Mike's program is for the veteran. What other groups do you team up with that's for the spouse or the children?
So we work with Give an Hour, which is free psychological services for veterans and their family members. And what the ideal scenario would be, as a veteran is working with Mike, we would work hand in hand with a family, with family services, family therapy, so that everybody can get on the same page and bridge that divide. The families being here stateside, their lives move forward. And when the veteran comes home, they've missed out on a lot. So how do you bridge that divide? Well, the peer-to-peer helps, and so does the family counseling. Because with the family counseling, you get a better idea of where the veteran's at, and you work hand-in-hand together, and you grow together on that same path versus the veteran just getting help or a family member, and then there'd be not a meeting of the minds, put it that way.
Right.
We want them on the same page. So for me personally, it's about transitioning back into the family, making it whole again, and then introducing a community piece so that the veteran and their family members can get reintroduced to their community, get more involved, maybe take on some projects, and then work on workforce readiness. It's easy to say you can hire somebody, but you really want to have a solid foundation with the family and community piece as well.
Well, and I know we have such a high unemployment rate for our returning veterans and their spouses, their family members. And I know that's why I started doing the From Battlefield to Business program, so that not everyone is suited to going to a 9-to-5 job after their experience in combat. So starting up entrepreneurs and getting people guided into, do you want to own a business that you can do from your home? Those types of things is really important to give everybody alternatives, whether that's the spouse that's here while their spouse is active duty, or their kids want something more. Parent, you know, they might be unemployed and be trying to take care for the grandchildren, like your grandparents' experience. We have to give them a lot of alternatives to get out there and be the best they can be in the environment that they need.
Exactly. So it's things go in threes for me. I keep talking about family, community, and workforce readiness, but really it's about creating a purpose, passion, and mission for our returning veterans so that they're not floundering. They need that purpose, passion, and mission in their life to make them successful and give them that solid footing.
I will absolutely agree with that on that. Purpose is so important for mental stability. We have a veteran that comes home where they do need to not work due to disabilities, or they just need to slowly work their way back into the community. Regardless, they need a purpose. Even if it's volunteering one day a week, they need a purpose. Everybody needs some type of purpose, but it's very important for mental health, well-being. Just to be able to get up every morning and have a goal and a purpose and know what your position and purpose in life is very important.
Well, it's back to that visual you have of someone standing in formation. They know where they are in that formation and their role. They come out, the formation is gone, and that role is no longer defined for them.
That's right. You know, there's not even barely 1% of the population in our country that runs towards what most people run away from. You know, and that's our firemen, our law enforcement, our ENT medical staff, you know, and then of course our military. And, you know, that's a very low percentage in the country. And so, you know, military and all the previous I mentioned, once you're out and you're not in that, don't have that purpose anymore, where you're basically running towards danger, taking care of that type of business, you're now home. It's very difficult to change your mindset and your thinking. I can remember some for me, just simply my wife and I got home, handed me a, you know, a grocery list one day. So, okay, you're back on the job. Here you go, Dad. And I take the two kids to the grocery store, and the first thing on the list was cereal. And I remember standing in the cereal aisle, and to me, there may as well have been a million boxes of cereal.
I was going to say, there's like 3,000 choices, right?
Yeah, I just spent, you know, over 2.5 years between training and deployment, and, you know, I never had a choice of what to eat. They threw something at us and you ate it and were happy about it. Ask for another if you can get it. And so just cereal, that blew my mind, because the topic on the checklist was kid cereal. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, it just blew my mind. It seemed like the aisle got longer and longer and longer, more stared at it. So that's how simple this thing is, how simple it is. You put it on a base level of how difficult it is to reintegrate into society.
I heard another veteran talk about the pasta aisle being the same way. You know, pasta with spaghetti, yeah, or elbow macaroni, and there were 3,000 shapes.
and you know, when it's funny because, you know, I'm a big cook. Cooking is therapy for me. So I know the pasta thing. So I know, you know, what dish I'm thinking of is what type of pasta now. Because, you know, but when I first got home, pasta was pasta. It didn't matter what it was. If it, you know, whenever it was a lasagna or spaghetti, you could use the same noodle. You know what I mean? To me. But, you know,
But it is those little things that, as you said, the world kind of goes on. You leave for deployment, your child isn't walking. You come back, your child is walking and talking, and maybe in preschool.
I have a story that can relate to that. When I left, I have four children now, but at the time I had one child before I deployed, and my wife was, you know, full term, right as I was supposed to get on the airplane and leave. And so I remember there was barely a week before I had to get on the airplane to deploy. And my wife had her last appointment with the doctor. And they checked the baby and they just said, okay, well, he's full term. He's fine. And he should come out when he's ready. And I remember my wife just busted out in tears. And the doctor kind of looked at her and said, it's okay. I know you want this baby out. I know you're tired of carrying the baby for 9 months. It's going to be okay. And of course, my wife started telling him, no, you understand. My husband leaves and he's going to be gone. I don't know how long. And so he found out why I was leaving for deployment. And he stepped out and then he came back in and said, hey, why don't you come in tomorrow? Let's have a baby. So got to induce that baby, and I held that baby every day on that plane, all day. And when I came back, he could walk and talk back to me. And so that's part of this infractions that happen with the Army. I mean, with the family. Even if you go through your experience and just come back and deal with experiences and not traumas or physical or mental traumas, that's a trauma alone. You come home, you've spent all this time seeing those baby pictures, seeing that kid grow, and you live in your mind. That's what you think about, your happy place while you're deployed. And you come home, and that child doesn't know you, knows your name, but knows you're not the mama or the daddy. It depends on how it goes. But so that's just some of the different things you go through.
From the spouse side, like you were talking about, the spouse is a single parent, so making all the decisions, deciding the discipline, what they'll let go, what they won't, and now you come home and there's someone to share those decisions with, and you've been used to doing it all on your own, and that transition has to be difficult.
That's right. You know, that's why the male soldiers used to call their spouses, we call them sergeant majors. That's because, you know, they are in charge, and you start to learn that because you're in and out, and when you come home, if you're used to non-deployed, you know, you co-parented, you know, you did what you're supposed to do. But then when you're in and out, like some of our soldiers are on these multiple deployments, or you're gone for a long deployment, and you come home, you know, things have changed, and kids have gotten older, and the daily routines aren't the same. And I learned very quickly I couldn't even make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich right. You know, I put the jelly on the wrong, you know, side. I'm like, okay, flip the sandwich over. No, it's still not right, you know? So it's interesting. But, I know we're having candor with it, but, one of the most difficult injuries, I truly believe, is the invisible injuries of war and the moral injuries of war. Someone can't see a soldier that is basically crippled mentally just from their trauma, things they've seen and had to have done, and they're just debilitating mental health traumas. And we're talking about PTSD or another a brain injury. They've been around some type of blast, and maybe they thought they weren't affected, but now they're starting to have effects when they get home. You know, acronym TBI, traumatic brain injury, even mild, can have memory issues, emotional problems happening due to that. And then you probably have PTSD on top of that. And so those soldiers are standing there, the men and women that have those issues, they are thinking, I've lost friends, or I have friends that are physically injured, they have horrible disabilities, you know, what is wrong with me? I'm fine. Because in the military, we're taught, no matter what, you get up, you brush your knees off, you rub some dirt on it, you keep going, if you're bleeding, you know, you don't stop. And so now when we're back home, you still have that same mentality, and there's a big stigma on mental health. It's getting a little bit better in the U.S., but it's still a big stigma. So people at least start to talk about it now. It used to be you didn't even talk about the mental health issue you had in your family.
Well, not too many weeks ago, I ran into someone. He was a veteran. I think it was from Vietnam or maybe Korea. And he said there was no such thing as PTSD. I said, well, it was known as shell shock. It was known as self-medicating, right? The alcoholism, the avoidance, the breakup of the families. I said, it's always been there. It's just labeled something different now.
Yeah, you know, and I've had some of the older generations, and some are very understanding, but some of the older generations, whether they were family members or actual veterans, they'll say, you know, I understand what's wrong with this generation. It seems like there's so many of them that have, you know, this PTSD thing. Well, here's part of it. So PTSD is an issue where you're on deployment and, you know, something happens to you. So the average person here at home, let's say, Lee, if you walk out of your car this evening and someone stuck a gun in your face and said, give me all your money, you're going to do one of a few things. You're either going to take off running, you're going to totally comply, or you're going to fight, right?
I'm the last one, but yeah, I'll be fighting.
But regardless of what three you pick, it doesn't doesn't matter which one of those decisions you pick, your mind at that time is going to shut down and say, okay, fight or flight. Let's let you do what you have to do to get you out of the situation, but you're going to owe me some emotional processing, right? So your mind totally shuts down all emotions, hopefully. But sometimes the best thing to do is just to turtle up and cry. It could make them just take your money and leave. But anyway, that's a defense mechanism as well. But regardless, when you get done, you know, here at home, when you can get done with that, you know, few minutes, hour or so of a trauma, the first police officer you see, or the first other civilian you see, the first family member, friend you talk to, you're going to process it. You're going to talk about it, whether angrily or cry about it, whatever you're going to do, but your brain's going to process that and get that emotion out. When it happens and you're in a situation where you can't stop, you have a bad event, your brain says, okay, we're not going to deal with this now. I'm going to let you get through it so you can get us home safely. Then you get back to your base, to your bunk, and you're sitting there, and your brain says, okay, we're kind of calm now. Okay, I know we were in a bad place outside the base, but we're inside the wire now versus outside the wire. And so let's start processing it. And then your mind, you'll hear some gunfire in the distance, or, you know, some rounds going off, something, and or some bad information coming with the radio. And then your brain says, you know, we're not safe right here. Let's hold on. That keeps going day after day after day. Your brain keeps saying, okay, I'm storing up this savings account you've got with all this emotion you need to be having, but I'm going to take withdrawal when we get to a safe place. A veteran gets home. You have 6 months to 2 years, what we call a honeymoon period. And that's where the mind is just allowing itself to be safe and kind of, you know, let you relax. It's giving you that little period, that grace period. But then at a certain point, one day when you least expect it, it's probably going to be on a very happy, perfect situation day. Your mind's going to come back to collect, and it's going to say, okay, you owe me for some traumas now. I'm making an emotional deposit right now. And that's when you have your first break or panic attack, anxiety attack. And it comes to collect, and your body's going to do it if you do not process it right away when you come home.
Well, and there's an author I've been reading, Dr. Caroline Leaf, and she has something called Switch On Your Brain. And she's been working with veterans in various parts of the world on how to process that through writing and other techniques. And it's finding some great success. So as we learn more about our brain and how PTSD and that compartmentalizing, hide it in the back of our brain till we can pop it out and deal with it, we're finding that the brain is a miraculous thing, and it can be dealt with later in a positive way. But again, if we're not talking about it and acknowledging it, whether it's someone getting attacked on the street, or, you know, the more we ignore it and try to keep it back there, the more the scar tissue builds up until it has to let itself out at some point. And it will, whether it's an appropriate response. It's that breakdown, it's pushing your family away, it's the cold emotions that Anne was talking about with her father. There's coping mechanisms that says, I'm not going to deal with that, so I'm going to put it in the back, and I'm not going to feel anything, so I'm not going to reconnect with my family just on the case something else bad's going to happen. And it's those defense mechanisms that we have to say, it's okay, it's time to lay those down, and we're here as a community, we're here as other veterans, we're here as family members, we're here as those who are beneficiaries of all that service to say, it's okay. Let us help you with all of these tools that are out there. And Anne, you're reaching out, the gala, other events, through other nonprofits, through people like Amanda telling their story. And how is that affecting the message of veterans entering transition?
People are welcoming us with open arms and always ask what they can do to help. And really the only thing I ask is, you know, if you need help, if you're a veteran or a family member, to, you know, utilize our services. And then if you know a veteran that could possibly use our help, let them know who we are. We want to grow in the community. It's not just a veteran problem or a family problem, but it's a community problem. We need to be aware of what's going on in our community. And the best way that we can serve our veterans and their family members is to be educated and know that there's issues out there that need to be dealt with. And sometimes just helping is listening or being able to point someone in the right direction to get them the help that they need.
Well, and if there are veterans in our family that were blessed to not come through with those emotional or even the physical scars of war, how can they get involved with either of your organizations? So what process is it for veterans to get involved, to get trained to become a peer counselor or help with the interventions, to be that person that's there within 24 hours to help? How can they get involved in that way?
They can visit our websites. We have forms available for volunteers where we can get in touch with them, figure out where they would best be placed within our organizations. If it's a veteran, I would strongly urge them to reach out to Mike with Outside the Wire Group. They can always use more peer-to-peer counseling. And in some cases, some of the veterans may need that peer-to-peer before they become the peers to get that experience. So there's so many different ways that people can help. It's just a matter of going to the website and just filling out a short form and giving us information so that we can figure out where you would fit in best. Because for us, it's about working your strengths, not your weaknesses. If you say that you're good at marketing, we're not going to put you in front of people to give a speech, you know, at marketing. Okay, well, how can you help us with social media? Or if, say, you are a public speaker and you've got experience, well, maybe you can go out to the community and speak to different organizations. There's so many different ways and levels that people can help out, and I really encourage it because it should be in our nature to want to give back and help those around us and create a positive atmosphere for everyone and just push away the negativity out there. We want to eliminate the stigma, especially where PTSD is concerned. What a lot of people don't understand is that the majority of the people that suffer from PTSD, believe it or not, are civilians. It's not our military. But we create such a stigma with media about how they think things should be perceived that we're misinformed. It's a matter of educating yourself and doing your research.
So if you had a wish list right now, what are the top three things on that item that your organization needs?
We need more veterans. I want more veterans to walk through our door. That's priority for us. And then, you know, volunteers to help with projects that may be coming up or events. And then if you can afford a donation, then a donation would be greatly appreciated as well.
Amanda, let's bring you back into the conversation. When you were out there and your husband had come home and you all were struggling with these issues, what was it that you were looking for that you wished you had or you wish someone had said to you during that period?
Unfortunately, I was not with my husband while he was active duty. I met my husband a year after he exited the military. My husband was a veteran of about 15 years when he took his life. So I was not with him during active duty, but I did have the aftershock, the after effects of war with him for the 15 years that we were together. And that's when he started having post-traumatic stress problems, suicide thoughts, survivor's guilt. He struggled several times with running into the woods, thinking he was saving his soldiers, helicopter noises, you know, stress during sleep. He couldn't sleep. He couldn't function. So he was in and out of jobs. He eventually went to nursing school and became a nurse 6 months before he took his life.
And when you look back on that experience, you sort of, like you said, you didn't live through his original combat, but you lived through the 15 years of him reliving that combat. What would you have liked to know from day one of your relationship with him? What would you say to someone else in your situation? What steps should they take before anything starts happening?
When we met, I didn't know about the stories. He bottled up a lot of his emotions, a lot of his fears. And it took several years for him to actually even open up to any of the war stories or any of the problems that he was having. And he was fighting the battle in his own head alone, without telling anybody. So it took us many years to even get to the VA. And then when he did, he eventually went, but then kept slipping through the cracks. He kept getting help through the clinics. They kept diagnosing him. He thought that his disability was going through, and after he died, did I find out that they never completed that for him, or completed helping him, or whatever the process is at the VA. So as a spouse and family member, I would say walk alongside your soldier, man or woman, and help them through the process, because as I have learned, I thought that the VA was doing that with him. But unfortunately, after his passing, I came to the conclusion that they weren't doing that as I thought they were. And I think that it's very important to be the family member that holds his hand or her hand during that process, so that you know that the VA is taking care of your soldier, because ultimately they are your soldier. They're home with you, they're living with you, and you're going through the same stresses they're going through on top of taking care of the kids and the family and everything else that goes along with that.
And hearing your story, I can't help but think there has to be some regret, some thinking, I should have caught it, I should have known, and those types of things. So how does Ann's organization and the other nonprofits that are out there providing services help lift you out of that process?
There's a lot of regret, Lee. So many thoughts that I can't even process how many thoughts have gone through my head. But just the organizations that I've connected with, Anne has helped me, you know, realign my responsibilities through the community. If ever I get off course, you know, she's always an ear, somebody to rely on. I've worked with Mike. He's trying to help me also, and Anne, get advocate for my appeal and my case to take it farther. I started the whole process alone. I've written the VA. I've spoke with people at the VA. I've contacted my senators and governors, and I've ultimately got denied again. So now with Anne and Mike in the picture, I feel a little more confident that I will be connected with the correct people, and then they can help my case and my story and my husband's legacy of being a great soldier to come alive.
You know, Lee, you're asking great questions. And, you know, a lot of this comes down to it's education. And a lot of people don't look at mental health as a disease. To your question of what would you do or what do you wish you know, things like that, it really comes down to education. But if people just look at mental health disorders as a disease, it's no different than cancer. If you came on home one day and your spouse, your child, your mother, father, whoever, whatever family member was laying in the bed and couldn't get up, and you say, what's wrong? And they say, I don't know, I just hurt and I can't move. Okay, that'd be the same type of response from someone who's in deep depression. You come home and they just gotten out of the couch all day, what's wrong? They say, I don't know, I just can't get up, you know? So, well, what you would do if they said they were in pain, you would take them to the doctor. And you would listen to the diagnosis, and I said they have cancer. Okay, well, you're not just going to tell your family member, well, you have cancer, so go to the hospital and do what you got to do. No, you are going to take them to appointments. You're going to listen to education. You're going to try and figure out what they need, what you need to do as a caregiver. You know, that's normal for us. We would do that when it's a physical health condition or something that, you know, a name we're used to dealing with. But mental health has such a stigma to it that a lot of time, you know, family members still, they just don't get to have the education. And it takes the family taking care of family and veterans taking care of veterans and becoming educated on, for the veteran becoming self-educated and for the family becoming educated on what they need to do for support.
And I'm also trying to bring awareness, you know, like Mike's peer-to-peer or mentor counseling, because I believe that if my husband Aaron would have known about his organization, then him or I or both of us could have reached out and got that peer-to-peer counseling and mentorship that I think he so desperately needed. That is something I, as a wife, could not provide.
Well, and again, we see the world through our own experiences, and only a vet can understand what a vet went through. A spouse can only understand what the spouse went through. The kids understand what other kids are going through. And as much as we can empathize and we want to do it, if our vet came home in one piece, no physical or mental injuries, then
we wonder, why didn't everyone, or why, what was different? And so what was that brain wiring, that life experience, that personality difference that made us blessed not to have to deal with that? My brother was in the Marine Corps, didn't serve in active duty, but did spend a year overseas in Okinawa. And he was a different man when he came home from that. Some PTSD, I would argue, yes. But again, it's that connection, that ability to say, yes, let's, you know, let it out in whatever constructive way is there. Sometimes the only ways it comes out are destructive ways. And finding that right job, that right purpose, that hobby, that passion, that new mission, as Anne was talking about, makes that difference to reconnecting.
Yeah, you talk about the destructive ways. You know, I can't tell you how many veterans I see. I can tell by their posture and the way they walk or the way they ride or driving or riding, whatever. But I'll see so many these young kids are coming back and they're on their motorcycles and they're the ones weaving in and out of traffic, going as fast as they can. You know, and that's one of the destructive waves. They're trying to stay on that adrenaline rush they had when they were deployed, and they come home and they don't have that anymore. That's a drug. That's an addiction. And there's a lot of self-destructive behavior that happens when you come home if you don't get the right type of help and deal with your the emotional side of a deployment. And a lot of it is survival skills. And I mentioned that. Survival skills is something that happens to all veterans. You always think, why me? Why somebody else and not me? And it's even difficult when you're now out of the service and some of your friends are still in and you're hearing about them passing. You'll have survivor's guilt now and you weren't even deployed with them. Because you'll think in your mind, what if I would have been there? You know? So it's very difficult. But, those are self-medicating type of things, whether it's you're trying to chase that adrenaline rush still, or you're dealing with drugs, alcohol, self-destructive behavior of some type. Those are still addictions.
Well, and that need for speed to kind of try to outrun your thoughts. You can see people on those motorcycles, on the road. You know, it might even be physically working out and running marathons, but they're so focused trying to outrun what they know is going on in their mind.
Yes, and that's why, you know, some guys I know and girls will come back and they will work out 7 days a week, you know, and say they're doing great, they're doing fine, working out, saving them. Well, it's not. It's bottling up and they're using that that negative emotion energy. They're pounding out with the weights, but it's all still there. As soon as they stop, they're not basically burning themselves out to exhaustion every night. It'll creep up on them and get them. But, no matter what, you have to talk it out. I think I was bringing it up before and I got off topic, but it's been asked to me, why is our generation of veterans, our Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, why does it seem like they have so much more cases of PTSD? Well, it's not. It's the same ratio, the same percentage of soldiers still get PTSD. The thing is, once it wasn't talked about, we're talking about from revolutionary on to current. All wars, all conflicts. It wasn't talked about back in the old days. But then, you know, World War One, World War Two, how did we deploy? It was by boats, right? We didn't get flown. You know, within 20 hours, you weren't to your destination. You got on a boat, and it took, several months to get over there. And then same thing for coming home. They were, by World War Two still, they were still coming home on boats. And that was a big decompression time. They got to be on those boats and those boys back, and that was actually one of those perfect scenarios. And we can't do that now because you can't bring people home and lock them down on the base. Because I know me myself, I climb the fence to get home to see my wife and kids. But it was a perfect release situation there where they had more time to be on that float and that ship back home, and talk with their buddies, laugh about things, cry about things, process it however that individual needs to do with their battle buddies, and then get home and reintegrate. It helped them a little bit better being able to have that decompression time, that buffer between combat zone to the living room. And Vietnam's the same way. We were on flights at that point, but still, from the time you got out of your combat zone and then you're on a base where it was your redeployment base to get back home, there was still a good little buffer period. Still nowhere near enough. It got much shorter, but still some time. Now, we could be home within 48 hours. You could literally shoot your weapon, clean it, get to your plane, and be home within 48 hours. That's how fast, And that is no decompression time whatsoever.
Well, and we also have more, with the advent of our medical interventions, we have more people returning injured and living, which is a great thing. But we also have to deal with those scars.
There's so many like me that walk around the invisible injuries. You got your brain injuries and PTSD, but like your brain injuries, you know, these injuries we should not have survived. Other wars we wouldn't have, whether it's because of the type of vehicles we were in or our body armor or whatever we have. And then it's the different type of enemy we have. It's the different way that everybody's heard about the IEDs, roadside bombs. You know, a lot of what they're using are shells that were shot from a mile away. It would land and do devastating. If it landed anywhere near you, you wouldn't walk away from it. But now they're planting them in the ground. So what you're getting a lot of is just a concussion wave. Some of the nasty stuff doesn't hit you unless you're pretty close to it. But you're getting a concussion wave. And so people think when they just get knocked down, they can stand back up. They're okay. They used to be, we had an explosion. I can't tell you how many I went through. As long as everybody got up and could brush knees off and keep walking, we kept walking. And you didn't even report it. Now, they've gotten it right that you do an MRI, so a brain scan, before you deploy, so they have a baseline. And then if something happens to you, you get scanned and they can tell if there's been some type of change. But it's just the culture has changed, at least as far as looking for TBIs and understanding. You don't just have to come back on a stretcher to have a brain injury.
Well, I don't want to kind of wrap up now. We're at the end of the hour, and I want to thank you all for being on the show, Ann, Amanda, Mike. And I want to direct everyone that's listening to go to myusvet.org or look up Outside the Wire Group and do what you can to support these organizations and our heroes and their families that are coming home. And everyone, until next time, stay focused on the important things in life.